So imagine you're a fish living right off the coast of China.
Okay, I'm a fish.
And the ocean around you is getting hotter every single year, like noticeably hotter. Do you swim north to survive?
Well, you'd think so, right? That seems like the logical move.
Right. But, well, if you absolutely love the heat, you actually run for your life. But if you prefer things a bit chilly, you actually just stay put.
Which is wild because it completely upends how we usually picture global warming in the ocean. I mean, we tend to visualize this, massive coordinated traffic jam of marine life.
Packing their bags and moving.
Exactly, just packing up and swimming toward the poles to cool off. But the reality is a highly complex, really fragmented reshuffling.
Which brings us to today's deep dive. Welcome in, everybody. We are looking at a really fascinating 2024 study published in the Science of the Total Environment.
That's a great paper.
Yeah, it really is. And the mission today is to explore this massive paradox happening in the Yellow Sea and the Bohai Sea.
Right, so the researchers tracked nine representative fish species in that area.
And before you think, for you listening, that nine species sounds like a small sample size. Those specific fish have historically made up like 80% of the total catch in this region.
Yeah, that's a massive volume of biomass. So, I mean, this isn't just an ecological headcount.
No, not a bit.
It's a direct preview of our future global food supply. We're essentially watching the foundation of an entire regional economy just prepare to relocate.
Okay, let's unpack this because predicting where millions of fish are going to be in what, 40 years? That sounds like trying to predict the weather a decade in advance.
It is tricky.
So how are they actually mapping this out?
Well, they're using these things called dynamic bioclimate envelope models, or DBEMs.
Okay, dynamic bioclimate envelope models.
Right. Because historically, ecological models were pretty binary. They looked at a map, they looked at the water temperature, and basically just guessed whether a species was present or absent.
So a very static approach.
Exactly, super static. But these dynamic models, they treat the ocean like a living, breathing machine.
Meaning they account for like the actual life cycle of the fish.
Yes, precisely. They factor in things like intrinsic population growth, adult emigration, and crucially, larval dispersal.
What larval dispersal, like where the babies go.
Yeah, because when fish reproduce, they release these microscopic larvae that just drift on ocean currents.
Oh, right.
So you literally can't predict where the adult fish will be in, say, 2060 if you don't calculate how far their babies are going to drift on these warming currents today.
That makes total sense.
Yeah, it calculates dynamic biomass, the actual physical volume of life moving through the water over time.
I am kind of stuck on the temperature data they plugged into these models, though.
Oh, the climate scenarios.
Yeah. Because they ran predictions from like 1970 all the way to 2060, right? Using three different Earth system models, GFDL, IPSL, and MPI.
Right, those are the big global climate models.
Yeah. And they mapped out different emission pathways, like RCP 2.6 for low emissions and RCP 8.5 for high emissions. But looking at that high emissions, business as usual trajectory, the data shows a massive discrepancy between the top of the ocean and the bottom.
It really does. It's staggering.
The surface water is heating up drastically, like up to 0.229 degrees Celsius every decade
Yeah.
under that high emission scenario.
Yeah, it's cooking.
But the ocean floor is warming at a tiny fraction of that rate, right around 0.054 degrees per decade. So I have to ask, are we just guessing how the water warms? Or is there a physical reason the surface and the bottom are so completely different?
There's definitely a physical reason. That gap between the surface temperature and the bottom temperature is basically the invisible engine driving this whole reshuffling.
Okay.
The upper layers are absorbing the vast majority of atmospheric warming and solar radiation.
Right. So I keep picturing a two-story house in the middle of July with a broken AC.
That's a great analogy.
The upstairs bedroom, the surface of the water, it just turns into an absolute oven. But if you walk down into the basement, the ocean floor, it actually stays surprisingly cool.
Exactly.
But in a house, hot air naturally rises.
No.
In the ocean, the sun is beating down on the top. Why doesn't that heat eventually just like mix all the way down to the seabed?
Because of ocean stratification, it's like trying to mix oil and water.
Oh, because of the density.
Bingo. When the sun heats the surface water, that water becomes less dense. It becomes physically lighter than the cold water beneath it.
I see.
So instead of mixing downward, the warm water just sits on top, creating this intense thermal barrier. The colder, denser water is just trapped down in the basement, completely insulated from the heat wave happening in the attic.
Wow. So you basically have two completely different climates occupying the exact same GPS coordinates, just separated by, what, a few dozen meters of water?
Precisely. And because the ocean is warming so unevenly from top to bottom, the fish that inhabit those different vertical layers are living in two entirely different realities.
Which sets up how the researchers categorize the fish, right?
Yes. They split them into two distinct habitat groups based on depth. First, you have the surface dwellers, or pelagic fishes, hunting and living in the middle and upper layers.
And second, you have the bottom dwellers, the demersal or benthopelagic species, hovering right above the seabed.
Right. And what's fascinating here is how these two groups react in the simulations.
Yeah, tell me.
Under the high-emission RCP 8.5 scenario, those surface dwellers show a massive, aggressive tendency to migrate northward.
Escaping the heat.
Exactly. They are abandoning the Southern Yellow Sea and crowding up into the Bohai Sea and the Northern Yellow Sea to find cooler waters. But if you look at the bottom dwellers...
Here's where it gets really interesting.
Yeah.
Because you'd assume all fish are fleeing the heat, right? Mm-hmm. If the whole ocean is technically warming, why are the bottom dwellers just sitting there?
Yeah.
Their geographic distribution remains incredibly stable.
Well, the basement is buffering them. I mean, we hear a lot about marine heat waves in the news, right?
Right. Those severe, prolonged spikes in ocean temperatures.
Yeah. But those heat waves overwhelmingly devastate the upper layers. The data shows that the thermal stress on those bottom-dwelling species is minimal. It's almost indistinguishable from just normal, natural variability.
I have to wonder, though. I mean, even if the bottom water isn't warming as fast, it is still warming a little bit. Is temperature the only reason the bottom dwellers are staying put?
What do you mean?
Well, surface fish are generally built like torpedoes, right? They're cruisers. Bottom fish are often built to, I don't know, hover or hide in the mud and ambush prey.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. That physiological difference is a major factor. Surface-dwelling fish are just highly mobile by design.
They can swim fast.
Right. They can easily swim hundreds of miles to chase a preferred temperature band. Bottom-dwelling species simply don't have the biological hardware to migrate long distances quickly.
So even if they wanted to leave, they couldn't?
Exactly. Even if their environment became slightly uncomfortable, they're geographically anchored by their lack of mobility. Plus, as you know, pelagic fish just naturally move faster than demersal fish.
Add to that the human element, too.
Oh, for sure.
I mean, the surface isn't just hotter. It's where all the cargo ships are, where the agricultural runoff sits, where the plastic floats.
Mm.
The surface dwellers are dealing with this brutal cocktail of stressors.
While the bottom dwellers are largely shielded from a lot of that immediate surface chaos, which paints a very clear picture based on depth alone.
But their researchers didn't stop at depth.
No, they didn't. They added another layer to this analysis that resulted in a completely counterintuitive finding. They didn't just look at where the fish live vertically. They looked at their internal thermostats.
Right. They categorized the fish by the water temperatures they naturally prefer.
The thermophily groups, yeah.
So you have the warm-tempered fishes, species that comfortably cruise in water between, say, 12 and 20 degrees Celsius.
The mild temperature lovers.
And then you have the warm water fishes, the true heat lovers, that thrive in water above 20 degrees Celsius.
So based on that, if the entire ocean is getting hotter, which group would you assume is the most desperate to escape?
Well, logic tells me the warm-tempered fish, the ones that prefer, you know, 15-degree water, would be panicking. And the warm water heat lovers should be throwing a pool party.
Right. It seems obvious.
If you already love 22-degree water, global warming sounds like a pretty great deal for you. Wouldn't the warm water fish be totally fine while the warm-tempered fish are forced to flee?
You'd think so, but the models show the exact opposite. It's wild.
Wait, really?
Yes. The warm water fishes, the heat-loving ones, are actually the ones exhibiting a significantly stronger response to climate change. They are migrating much more widely and rapidly to the north.
And the ones that prefer mild water?
The warm temperate fishes are largely staying put.
I need a breakdown of the mechanics there. How does a fish that thrives in hot water end up fleeing a warming ocean faster than a fish that actually likes it cool?
It all comes down to a concept called the thermal safety margin.
All right.
Let's look at the starting conditions. Warm water fishes generally start out at lower latitudes, right? Closer to the equator where the water is already very warm.
Sure.
Because they are adapted to these hot environments, they generally have higher thermal ranges, but they are operating constantly near their absolute maximum physiological limit.
Ah, I see. Like a car engine that's permanently redlining. It's designed to go fast, but if you push it even a tiny bit harder, the whole thing just blows.
That is a perfect way to visualize it. So a warm temperate fish might be sitting in 15-degree water. Its absolute maximum limit might be, say, 22 degrees.
Okay.
If the ocean warms up by 2 degrees, that fish is now swimming in 17-degree water. It's slightly warmer, yes, but they still have a massive 5-degree thermal buffer before their biology actually starts failing.
But the warm water fish doesn't have that buffer. If its maximum limit is 25 degrees and it's already living in 24 degree water, a simple 1 degree spike is lethal.
Exactly. They cross a biological red line almost instantly. They are highly vulnerable to even slight warming. Their enzymes stop working correctly, their oxygen demand outpaces what their gills can supply,
Wow.
and their proteins literally begin to denature. So even though they have a higher tolerance for heat overall, their safety margin is practically zero.
That makes so much sense now.
The moment the heat cranks up even slightly, their only option for survival is a rapid, immediate evacuation northward to find suitable conditions.
So what does this all mean? Like, for the actual ocean map, we've established the biology, right? The surface dwellers and the warm water fishes are sprinting north, while the bottom dwellers and the warm temperate fishes are just sort of anchoring in place. When we fast forward to 2060, what are the macro level consequences?
If we connect this to the bigger picture, we are looking at a fundamental redrawing of the ocean's ecosystem, and it has massive implications for the humans who rely on it.
What does the geography actually look like in the projection?
By 2060, the models project that the Bohai Sea and the Western Nearshore waters are going to see a massive influx of new species.
Like an ecological immigration wave.
Exactly, a huge wave of immigration. But down in the south central offshore waters of the Yellow Sea, we are going to see staggering rates of extirpation.
Extirpation. That's essentially local extinction, right? Where a species isn't wiped off the face of the earth completely, but it just completely abandons a specific area.
Yes. Those southern waters essentially become ghost towns for these crucial commercial fish, which creates a logistical nightmare for fisheries management.
Because our entire system is based on historical geography.
Right. Fishing communities, processing plants, port infrastructure, they've all been built over generations in specific coastal towns because that's where the fish have always been.
And you can't just pick up a multi-billion-dollar coastal economy and move it 500 miles north overnight.
No, you can't. The current systems are just totally inadequate for a world where fish are abandoning their historical grounds.
So the paper suggests some drastic shifts in policy then.
They do. They argue we need to control fishing effort aggressively. Things like strict total allowable catches or tax.
Capping the total tonnage of a species that can be pulled from the water each year.
Exactly. And alongside that, they advocate for individual transferable quotas or ITQs.
Which changes the whole psychology of fishing. Because if there's no quota, it's just this chaotic race, right?
Yeah.
Every boat rushes out to catch as much as possible before the other guy gets it.
To the tragedy of the commons.
Right, which devastates an already stressed fish population. But if a fisher owns a guaranteed percentage of the total catch for the year, an ITQ, they can fish methodically or even sell their quota to someone else.
Yeah.
It reduces that frantic pressure.
It does. But beyond quotas, the researchers emphasize we have to fundamentally change the physical gear we use.
Like what?
We have to stop bottom trawling.
Dragging those massive weighted nets across the seabed.
It's basically underwater bulldozing. It indiscriminately destroys complex seabed habitats. The very basements that we just learned are acting as crucial thermal refuges for the bottom-dwelling fish.
So what do we do instead?
The paper suggests swapping these destructive methods for environmentally friendly alternatives, like light trapping.
Light trapping, how does that work?
So many marine species are naturally phototactic.
Meaning they're attracted to specific wavelengths of light.
Exactly. So instead of dragging a heavy net through a fragile seabed, fishers can use sterilized LED lights suspended in the water column to lure the target species up to the surface.
Oh, that's incredibly clever.
It's highly targeted, drastically reduces bycatch, and leaves the ocean floor completely untouched.
And they also advocate for establishing no-take marine protected areas, right? MPAs.
Yes. If these fish are spending massive amounts of biological energy just trying to survive the warming water and migrate, they need safe havens where they aren't also dodging nets.
We have to give them the space to rebuild their biomass.
It's the only way to ensure the ecosystem doesn't collapse.
I'm looking at this whole DBEM modeling approach, though. It's like a highly detailed map, but a map is only as good as what it actually includes.
That's a very fair point.
It feels like they're treating a complex 3D world a bit like a flat 2D plane. Like if a surface-dwelling fish gets too hot, do they really have to swim 300 miles north? Couldn't they just swim 50 meters straight down into the cold water?
That is an excellent piece of critical thinking, and the researchers are very transparent about the blind spots in the study. DBEM essentially treats the ocean as a flat plane, completely missing vertical migrations.
Like fish swimming deep during the day and surfacing at night.
Right, diurnal vertical migration. Many species swim deep into the frigid water during the day to regulate temperature, then surface at night to feed. The model struggles to capture how climate change will alter that daily elevator ride.
And what about species interactions, like the food web?
Another huge limitation.
Because if a predator is a heat-loving surface fish, it flees north. But what if its prey is a mild temperature bottom dweller that stays put?
The model might predict the predator will thrive in the north because the temperature is perfect, completely ignoring that it just left its entire food supply behind. The resulting starvation isn't accounted for.
So ecological matchmaking is going to get entirely scrambled.
Absolutely. The model also ignores rapid physiological evolution, and it misses massive anthropogenic factors like pollution and overfishing.
Right, human pollution. Because you could have a grid on this map that has the absolute perfect temperature for a fish, but if agricultural runoff has created a massive dead zone there, the fish will still suffocate.
Precisely. Hypoxia. Excess nutrients wash in, algae blooms, bacteria consume the dead algae and suck all the dissolved oxygen out of the water. The model doesn't know the water is literally unbreathable.
So while these models aren't perfect crystal balls, they provide an undeniable trajectory.
Yes, a trajectory that demands our attention right now.
So to recap for you listening, climate change isn't just some simple northward march for marine life. It's this incredibly complex, multi-layered migration,
where surface-dwelling and warm-water fishes are highly vulnerable and moving rapidly,
while bottom-dwelling and warm-temperate fishes are staying relatively put. And understanding these nuances is exactly what prevents you from falling for overly simplistic headlines about global warming. You now know the intricate mechanics of why different species react differently.
This raises an important question, though, one that pushes beyond just the biology.
Oh.
We've spent this whole time discussing the changing geography of the ocean, but the ocean has no physical borders. Human nations do.
Oh, wow. Right. The exclusive economic zones.
Yes. If economically vital warm water pelagic fish are fundamentally abandoning southern waters and migrating permanently into the northern exclusive economic zones of completely different countries,
how will global geopolitics adapt to that?
Exactly. We're looking at a world where a nation's natural resources can literally just swim across a border to escape the heat.
That is a staggering final thought. Our whole global trade system assumes resources are stationary. An oil field doesn't pack up and move. But the ocean's two-story house is undergoing a major renovation, and the tenants upstairs are breaking their leases and crossing international borders. Keep that thought with you next time you look out at the ocean. Thanks for joining us on this deep dive, and we'll catch you next time.